Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android Toolkit team.
And I'm Romain Guy from Android. I really need a name still for my team.
And we have guests today from the London office. We have...
Hi, Matt A. Pfeiffer from the Android ML product area.
And I'm Ben Murdoch from the Android engineering team working on ML recently.
It sounds like you're on the same team as Romain, just sort of this indistinct, yeah. I do Android stuff.
That's right. I've been here a little while, but yeah.
Okay. I haven't. I'm very new.
So we're in the London office today talking to people about ML in general, although I should point out that Ben is a repeat guest. Last time we talked to you about...
WebView
with Torn.
Torn,
right?
I believe. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yep. A few years ago. Yeah.
All right. So apparently you work on different things because you just work on Android in general.
Well, I think you just changed jobs to make sure you would be on the podcast again.
I'm flattered to hear it, even if it's not true. Don't correct that assumption.
It was a great
please.
Experience.
Yeah. okay, so ML, very buzzwordy. What does it stand for? Why are we talking about this? Machine learning, go. What is machine learning?
You want to take it back?
Okay, it's been a great podcast. Thanks for coming on today. All right, why don't we start with a more directed question? Let's start with some of the stuff that happened in the P release.
Yeah. Here in London, we worked on two of the flagship ML features for Android Pie. So collaborating with DeepMind, the AI machine learning research group that's part of Alphabet. And we delivered adaptive brightness and adaptive battery.
So I like adaptive brightness as a user because I've been using Android since Android 1. And auto brightness pretty much never really worked. I was always having to correct what the OS was doing. And P, I think, is the first time where I basically never have to touch the slider again. So what happened? How did you make that work?
I'm really glad to hear that because it means we did it right. So when we were researching collaborations with DeepMind on what would be some good problems to solve, we had heard this feedback that adaptive brightness maybe wasn't working so well. And when we sort of looked into how it was done in previous releases, it was kind of a fixed algorithm, so the same thing for all users. With some the slider in previous releases kind of scaled the curve, and that's how it sort of personalized to your current lighting environment. But we thought there was room for more personalization, and kind of different people prefer different brightnesses and different conditions. And so that's where we thought machine learning might be a good way to improve the user experience. And we set about building some prototypes and got some early good feedback about the user experience being improved. So we decided to take it forward.
So to be clear, we didn't add new sensors to the device. We just changed the software that was there on the platform.
Exactly. Yep. The hardware is the same in terms of it's a ambient light sensor that reads the lux is the unit of measurement of ambient light. The machine learning takes that as input to its algorithm when you interact with the slider. So we observe how you interact with the slider in different conditions, and that's what the ML algorithm uses as its input. So it tries to see what you're adjusting the slider to, given the conditions, and then tries to fit a curve to that we can then apply for you.
Okay. So the ambient light sensor is the only input we take. We don't look at what time it is or things like that.
Mm-hmm. At the moment, no. But in future iterations of the algorithm, we're looking at trying to incorporate more context into it, so it becomes even smarter and learns a better preference for you.
Can I have a version that takes into account my email? So every time I get an email from Chet, the screen just turns off.
We'll look into that.
Moving on. Next subject. So this sounds like a lot of effort. It actually just sounds like another rewrite. Like what I was used to, I joined in at the start of the Honeycomb release, and every single release, somebody would rewrite the screen brightness because it wasn't working yet. So a lot of engineering effort went into this. I always thought it would just be easier to just rename it to random brightness, just represent what the system was doing instead. But maybe this is the last rewrite, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, I'm sure. We're engineers. We never re-engineer anything. All right, so we had screen brightness, and then the other big thing that kicked in, which is more of a developer-related feature, is the adaptive battery stuff.
Adaptive battery and app standby buckets. This is a move to try and improve power consumption on the device so that the battery lasts longer. We've seen sort of at Google I.O., Dave presented his triangle of user needs with kind of battery at the very bottom. We know battery is really important. It's what enables you to do all the cool stuff on your phone. In the platform, there's now a notion of what we're calling app standby buckets. And this is before any sort of ML gets involved. This is a framework component or feature. And apps get assigned into buckets. When an app is in a given bucket, various restrictions get placed on it on what it's allowed to do in the background. The idea being is that some apps maybe are more important to the user at a given time, and they should have more privilege than others to use battery as a background resource. So there are four standby buckets defined. There's the active bucket, the working set bucket, the frequent bucket, and the rare bucket. And they're named broadly in line with how a given user is using that app.
Maybe there could be a fifth. If you don't fit into any of the buckets, then it could be beyond the pale.
We do have kind of a notion of a none bucket if you haven't been used yet. But that's not one that we would typically move between.
Okay.
So during an app's kind of lifetime on the device, as it's used or not used by the user, it will transition between these buckets. There's more documentation on developerandroid.com about exactly what those buckets mean.
Right. I think Madan gave a talk at I.O. as well, right?
Yes, exactly. Yep. So there's also some I.O. material for that.
So as an app developer, am I aware of what bucket my app is currently in? Can I do something about it?
Yes. So there's an API that allows you to retrieve what bucket you're currently in. So you can potentially scale back what jobs you're scheduling or alarms you're scheduling to kind of cope with that. There's also some ADB APIs to allow you to force your app into a given bucket. So while you're testing, you can see how the behavior changes make sure that your app is working well or as expected as it might transition through those buckets.
So what are the kind of restrictions that are imposed on the applications in these buckets?
Mm-hmm. So the restrictions at the moment in P are around your ability to run background jobs, alarms, and interact with FCM, Firebase Cloud Messaging.
Okay.
So if your app is in the active bucket, you're broadly unrestricted. Active tends to map to an app the user is actively using, very recently used, or when we start talking about the ML side of it, that we predict you're going to be using it very soon. So it allows the app a bit of time to get into its ready state before the user actually launches it. And that's fairly unrestricted. As you move down the buckets, the restrictions become a bit stronger. Working set and below applies restrictions on jobs and alarms and the frequency at which you can have them executed. As you move down into frequent and rare, we also start to place quotas on the amount of high priority FCM messages your app can receive. And once you exceed that quota, your FCM messages will be downgraded to normal priority rather than high priority.
Okay. And do you, maybe this is a question for later when we talk about the full scope with the ML niceties, but have there been results from this? So my observation using more recent devices and releases is, well, if I leave my phone alone and it doesn't happen to get plugged in for a while, actually the battery does much better than it did, a couple of years ago, a couple of releases ago. But that's just purely anecdotal and I wouldn't trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we've done tests we have seen an improvement in the battery life. We've also seen other metrics moving in terms of the number of background jobs and alarms running are reduced as we're in line with our expectations. We've also seen improvements or reductions in the amount of background Wi-Fi and cellular data that's being used purely because fewer there's less activity going on in the background, there's all the kind of associated gains with that. So we see fewer CPU wake-ups, less data transferred over the radios, and all those kind of go together to lead to power improvements.
But it's interesting because it sounds like from the description of the bucket and adaptive battery that was trying to keep the strength of Android, which is having, you know, multitasking, apps running in the background, while giving the user like a better battery experience. So I like that we're not taking away existing features.
Yeah, that was really important when we sort of set out designing how the system might work, is that we did our best to maintain that, and that the user experience that for apps the user is actively engaging with wasn't compromised even while on battery.
Yeah, it's one of the frustrating things when you look at the log sometimes and you see a process obviously doing a lot and spewing a lot of logs, and you realize, I haven't run that application in months. Why is it doing this on my behalf? And so the restrictions that we're imposing in the last couple of releases, I think, make developers' lives a little harder, but we are preferring the lives of, you know, the many more users of the phones, right? So make it better for them and spend the battery on the things that they're actually using, as opposed to, you know, making it easier for developers to do things that maybe the user didn't want them doing in the first place.
Yep, I think that's right. And another thing to note as well, for apps that aren't used very often, if they're in the bottom bucket and subject to these restrictions, they will get an opportunity at least once per day to run their jobs and alarms, even if the device is on battery. And while the device is plugged in and charging, all the restrictions are released. So even apps that the user's not actively engaging with get a chance to do their background work while we're charging.
So it's like the dog in the apartment in the city. Eventually, the owner will come home in the evening and they will get to get out.
Yeah,
so it's okay. So actually, I wanted to return really briefly to a point you made about the amount of data. We had an earlier episode, I don't know, a couple of years ago with a couple of the people that had worked on Doze Mode. And they said that the implications of radio and communications in general are kind of huge, because it's not just sending of the message. It is CPU wakes up, radio wakes up, and then it stays awake for a while, right? So it'll sort of, well, a message comes in, so it, you know, needs to process that thing, and then just in case there's more traffic, it's going to stay up in a high frequency rate for a while, which means you've just burned that battery for that entire period, even if it didn't really need to do that. So if we can avoid that and do it in more, you know, these clumped batches, then it's far more efficient. Right?
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, so that's adaptive battery in general and all the bucket stuff. So where does ML kick in with that?
So ML comes in how we move apps between these buckets. So again, together with DeepMind, we built a model that tries to predict when you're going to use apps. The output of that model is which bucket the app should be in. And so we run this model on the device every hour or so, and it takes into account your previous usage of apps and then tries to predict what's going to come next and sets the buckets appropriately.
Okay. So that's interesting, because if I think about, you know, models that are on the device, they sort of come baked with this knowledge, but it's knowledge about heuristics to apply, but we don't know what it's on any particular device, right? We don't know the applications that are installed or the things that the user is doing. So it's an application of heuristics in a generic model applied to the specifics of actually what's on that device and who is using it.
Exactly. Yeah. So we trained an offline model based off of aggregated usage stats that we have. Then we apply that on the device to the user's specific history.
Okay.
So next obvious question is, if I'm a developer and I want to create my own models and run models on Android, what do I use? What's available to me? Because, you know, the platform tends to have things that are not always available to developers. Like, what's with ML?
It kind of depends on how much of an expert you are at ML. So if you're able to build your own models, you can use Google frameworks such as TensorFlow Lite to go ahead and run those on device. Now, on device, ML obviously has specific challenges because these are computationally intensive tasks. They use up a lot of power. So we use a lot of optimization techniques to make them more friendly to device health, put it that way. However, if you don't have ML expertise, you can use a product such as MLKit, for example. So MLKit's mission is essentially to make on-device ML an essential part of every developer's toolbox. So it's sort of making smart simple, if you will. So we provide Google made, we call them base APIs, so pre-built models for a variety of use cases that you can easily bundle up and use within your app.
Right, yeah, because I was wondering what the difference was between TensorFlow and MLKit. So you're saying that MLKit has models already built that I can use and I assume assemble, like connect together or something like that?
So MLKit actually runs on top of TensorFlow Lite. So we're at the sort of different parts of the stack. We collaborate very closely with the TensorFlow Lite teams. MLKit, if you want to use something that's pre-built, you know, you just bundle the SDK into your app. We make it very easy to switch from on-device ML to cloud ML, depending on the use case. Now, if you've built a custom model through TensorFlow Lite, we also have additional features that you can use through MLKit. For example, we make it very easy for you to actually deploy that model with your app. We support features such as A/B testing, for example. And one another important aspect is that machine learning models tend to be fairly large. So the footprint is a consideration. And MLKit comes with technology that compresses a very large TensorFlow model by orders of magnitude.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question because I've never done ML myself, but I heard many, many times, you know, we have teams working at Google and very often the early models seem to be a little too large for devices. I remember things for the keyboard where, you know, they had a model that was several gigabytes. And we're like, yeah, you can't really put that on the phone. That's, we need that space. So you're saying that MLKit has solutions for that. But is there something that you can do also when you create the model to make a smaller model? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, TensorFlow Lite also supports techniques that will make the model smaller. For example, quantization, so using integer weights and activations as opposed to floating point, and a number of other techniques that you can apply either as you train the model or post-training.
I'm going to play the part of the idiot in the room because I'm typecast.
It's a process you play really well.
Yeah, yeah, I'm a natural for it. I hear that from directors all the time. I have no idea what you mean when you say build a model. Or when you talk about TensorFlow Lite, like what are the APIs people are actually doing? What's the data that they provide? What's the output? Like, can you give us a more general statement about what the APIs are doing?
Yeah, so that's maybe referring to your first question, like, you know, ML, what is it?
Yeah.
What do we use it for? So it turns out that you can use ML to do a lot of really cool stuff for your users. For example, you can transcribe speech to text. You can understand what the user is trying to say. You can improve images. For example, you can figure out what objects are in the image and use that to provide an additional feature to the user, for example. So there's a wide variety of use cases for machine learning. The challenge with machine learning is, I guess, so threefold. One is that it takes expertise to build these models because different model architectures are applied for different use cases. The second one is that you do need a lot of data to train these models effectively. And not everyone has access to this training data. For example, if you want to build an image classifier, so a model that you would give an image to and it will say, this is a chair, for example. So that is trained on millions and millions of pre-labeled images, and not everyone has access to that. The third challenge is specific to on-device, just because the model needs to be small. It cannot use a lot of power. It needs to run fast. But on-device has a lot of advantages as well. For example, your data never leaves the device. So the privacy angle is really important. You don't use network bandwidth, also important. Latency is usually better with on-device. And, you know, it's always there. You're not relying on an external connection for a feature to work. It's just there on-device with you.
Okay, so let's walk through one of those examples then. How do you, what does the developer provide in order to get the output that they need? So take your example of chairs, right? So they're gonna need, you know, millions of pictures of chairs, and it's these images, what, have metadata associated with them, or there's, you know, APIs to say, here's your data, here's what these things are, and now figure out, you know, use your smarts to figure that out, and then they get a blob on the other end that is what, right?
Okay, so let's maybe start with a developer who might not have ML expertise, right?
Me, yeah. For example.
There we go. So what you could do, you could build ML, you could use MLKit from your app, and it's just a set of very developer-friendly APIs. You know, you give it an image, and you say, label, and you get an array of labels back. This is what's in the image, for example. Or you give it a live stream with a person with the user's face, and it will give back, okay, this is where the mouth is, and from that you can infer whether the user is smiling, for example, and things like that.
So MLKit has the built-in intelligence and data and models already to determine that from
input
images?
Yes, the models are pre-built. That is,
I see.
That is, I would say this is the main target audience of MLKit, is developers who may not have the expertise or data to train their own models. So they use something that's pre-built and it's ready to use very, very quickly.
Okay. So they're not building the models, they are using the models that you've already provided to get information about the data that they're giving you.
Correct. And then the other target audience of MLKit are developers with ML expertise, but who might need some assistance in terms of deploying their models for on-device use. So making them smaller, deploying them with their application, things like downloading models dynamically just to reduce the footprint, tools that allow you to do A-B testing to figure out which models work best, etc.
So how are they producing the models? So they're more sophisticated, they know what, how to spell model. Are they producing them on the back end with what, TensorFlow, with their own technology?
Correct. So developers would use TensorFlow or TensorFlow Lite to train those models.
Sorry, what's the difference between those?
So they're part of the same product family, TensorFlow, which is Google's machine learning framework. TensorFlow Lite is specifically aimed for on-device use.
Okay. All right.
So something you mentioned earlier is that one of the challenges of ML on device is power consumption and performance. Our devices like Pixel 3, we have 8 cores, we have a pretty powerful GPU. How are we running those models? Do we use CPU? Do we run GPU? Do we have other DSPs on the device that we use to run those models efficiently?
So the topic of acceleration is very important when it comes to on-device ML. You can run stuff on CPU for some computationally intensive applications such as video that might not be too slow. You might not be able to provide real-time processing in those cases. Also, you would typically use too much power, so you would revert to accelerating models on different hardware, and that includes DSPs, that includes special built NPUs that are more on the high-end devices, GPUs, etc.
So you said the NPUs?
Yes.
Okay, is that similar to the TPUs that we talk about at Google I/O? Okay.
Yeah, correct. They have different names on different devices, but that is essentially it, yes.
One other thing about MLKit, I think you told me earlier that it's a cross-platform toolkit, right? It's not just for Android.
That's right. MLKit is actually published through Firebase, so we provide support for iOS and Android. So developers.
Of course it's in Firebase. What is not in Firebase?
Such a nice product name. Let's apply it to everything. We actually learned that through machine learning. Let's see. So this came out recently, right?
Yeah, this was launched at I/O, actually.
I thought it was launched, but it wasn't actually like the developer APIs were released more recently. I thought there was something that had come out this fall related to MLKit.
So we keep launching new APIs. We launch improved face detection and face contour. We're working actively on a new feature that we've announced recently, which is called Smart Reply. So, the ability to take a context of a previous conversation.
Oh, so that's the feature we had already in notifications for Hangouts, for instance, but now you can use them in your own application with MLKit, right?
Yeah, not yet, but very soon.
Okay.
Okay. That's the one I was thinking of. I knew that was aimed around this time frame. So I was curious about your face detection thing. You said, okay, so the unsophisticated developers, such as myself, could pass in an image and MLKit could say, okay, here are where the eyes are, here is where the mouth is, and then the developer can do something more. What's the mode of giving me that information, right? Are you passing back geometry that says here are the following features?
So with face detection, step one is actually detect the faces. So you get bounding boxes of faces in the image. These are basically geo-coordinates of the faces. And then for each face, you get a list of facial landmarks and their positions.
Okay. And then the developer could say, okay, are they smile, or is that actually an MLKit thing? Like you also have models for what those features are actually doing.
So the pre-built models do provide some classification, like an indication of smiling, for example. And the use cases are varied. If you look at the applications using MLKit today, you would not believe like the wide range of use cases that this is being used for. A common example is transforming images, for example, applying, you know, makeup to someone's portrait, and this is where you need to identify, you know, where the lips are, etc.
Right. Oh yeah, I guess that has applications for like shopping sites if you want to see, you know, what this thing is going to look
like. Which sounds like could be useful for AR.
Yes. Yep. Also detecting grumpy cats in cat videos, I would think. Huge.
AR is actually an interesting example because AR uses a lot of the same models. AR uses a lot of ML, computer vision ML, to solve the problems.
Oh, right. Yeah, to detect the planes and occluders and things like that, I imagine, yeah. We should ask the AR core team what they use.
If only somebody in the room worked on AR-related technology.
I do the rendering. I don't do the smart stuff.
Okay. And then there's the smart replies. Can you talk about that? I'm just wondering in terms of, okay, so what does the developer do to access that information? How do they incorporate that into that?
So obviously the developer would, would bundle MLKit into the app, and that would come with a pre-built model for smart reply.
Yep.
At first, we're just going to go with support for the English language, and then, you know, extend that as we go on. The API is fairly simple. What you do, you give it a list of previous statements in a conversation. I believe it's up to 5. So speaker 1 said this, speaker 2 said that, etc. And then the model would produce as an output a list of possible responses to the previous statement, with an indication of how appropriate each of those responses would be.
Okay.
It's interesting because I've seen, you know, smart reply in Gmail and various other applications, and overall the suggestions tend to be really good, but I always feel guilty about using them. I feel like the other person will know that I didn't type that myself.
I have sometimes used my own reply that mimics exactly what the smart reply wanted to do for me, but mine was handwritten. It was really, it was carefully curated. It was
personalized.
Yes, it was.
Smart reply is an interesting challenge because, there's so many different applications for it. You can use it in sort of consumer chat, such as, Android messages. You can use it in something that's more, enterprise focused. For example, a conversation with a recruiter, for example, on LinkedIn or something.
No, thank you. I'm not interested. I could use that one all the time.
That's the one. And you have to train these models specifically for those use cases. It's very difficult to generalize.
All right. Are there other use cases that are interesting? So what was there at the beginning? So we just came out with, or we're coming out with, smart reply stuff now. What did we introduce in the original MLKit at I.O.?
So today MLKit has support for pre-built models for image labeling. So this is giving an image and getting a list of labels back, what is in that image.
Is there a weight to that? Like, is it, this is mostly a chair, but I also see a face in here?
Correct. So you have a list of labels and their probabilities.
I see.
So they're ranked. I believe that was one of the first APIs that was introduced.
Sorry, on that one, one of the things that I like best about the Photos product or the Photos app is the labeling, the fact that I don't have to label my images anymore. Is that using the same underlying technology?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
That is correct.
Image labeling is the hello world of machine learning.
Correct. Yes.
Which is weird because that's pretty damn awesome hello world.
Yeah, that's much better than any hello world I've written.
So then there's OCR, so text recognition, barcode scanning, for example. Also a commonly used machine learning case.
I want to understand that one. Why? I think of barcode scanning as just being very deterministic. This is what the code stands for, period. So what's the ML side of that?
If you use ML, you can actually do slightly better in terms of recognizing barcodes. You have, you know, curved surfaces.
I see.
Then you have, so we've already mentioned face detection and face contour, so the facial features. Then we have landmark recognition. For example, you know, you give it a photo of, a London landmark, Big Ben. Probably not now because it's all covered up, but
yeah.
And it will say, hey, this is Big Ben, for example.
And it'll say, cloudy day. Yeah, okay.
Something like that.
Cool. Did we miss anything? Did I ask all the right questions? Because I'm not sure I know all the right questions.
I think so. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, and obviously, this is only the beginning, right? There's going to be more models, more features coming to MLKit. And I imagine the Android platform is going to use more ML in the future. Maybe we should start learning that, Jet. Oh, maybe we could use it for the podcast so you don't have to do the podcast anymore.
Oh, maybe we could, yeah, we could just have a model do this instead. It can be the idiot in the room, except it would be a lot smarter. Okay, so people get started by going to MLKit site and reading the docs and downloading the thing.
Well, where is the MLKit site? Is that Firebase or is that developer.android.com?
It's actually both.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Cool. Thanks.